You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Andrew Day.
Hi, Bob. Happy International Women's Day.
Is it International Women's Day?
It is.
And
yes.
I did not buy my wife a thing.
That's not good. If you have a Russian wife, you have to care about International Women's Day.
Do you realize it's a big thing in Russia?
It's a very big thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it kind of a communist thing? I mean, not that that's a bad thing, but is your wife like, or has she
ever been? Is she a communist?
Yes.
I think her great grandpa was a KGB agent, but no, she has no communist sympathies that I know of. And International Men's Day is also a big thing. So
I've always it's escaped my notice, but I'm looking forward to it now that I've heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm like, in general, I'm a pretty good husband. A funny thing happened this last anniversary, which is like, it was like a round number anniversary. Mm-hmm. Like, and so I went all out. I got like jewelry and stuff. And my sister-in-law advised me because I was actually in Colorado where she lives when I was buying the stuff. And I gave it to Lisa. She seemed really gratified and excited. And then like a couple of months later, she said, what year were we married? And I said, 1988. She said, so this was our 35th wedding anniversary. And I said, yeah, why'd you think I got you all that jewelry? And she said, yeah, I thought that was kind of weird. But I am a good husband. Anyway, listen.
Sounds like it. Mm-hmm.
Listen, you work with me closely, and I want you to answer a question. Am I the kind to seek pity, Andrew?
You're not. No, not typically.
Good. I wasn't sure how you're going to answer that, actually. But I just want to point, my smartwatch says that last night I got 2 hours and 56 minutes of sleep, which accords with my subjective experience. It says that the night before I got 4 hours and something. So mm-hmm. I'm not going to make excuses in advance. Like if I start sounding like Joe Biden, or sound like him already,
mm-hmm.
but I do think I have kind of a get out of jail free card. Yeah.
To be honest, the Happy Women's Day opening was kind of a curveball because I wanted to see how you would handle it, given your
lack
of sleep. You did.
I handle it very deftly.
I think you're fine.
Thank you. So this is Earthling Unplugged. We work together and put out the Earthling each week. It comes out on Fridays. We're not quite done with a newsletter, so I don't know why we're kicking back and like laughing and stuff. Because my duties in particular have not been entirely discharged.
Mm-hmm. Like writing the main thing, the lead item.
Yeah, but you've read the first part of that, right? It has momentum.
It does. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So did you the State of the Union? Now, last night I was working on the newsletter. So I didn't really watch it. I kind of kept track of the Twitter reaction. Then this morning I bit the bullet and listened to about the first half, I guess, while I was trying to get my shit together, as we say in the 3 hours of sleep a night business.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you listen to the whole thing?
I did. I watched the entire thing live. And watched the little bit that happened before it, because, you know, he was a little late, I think, maybe because of these pro-Palestine protesters blocking his motorcade. I haven't seen that confirmed, that actually delayed him. But yeah, I watched the whole thing. Of course, you know, Trump, in addition to the Supreme Court ruling unanimously 9-0 that states can't kick him off the ballot, he did really well on Super Tuesday. Nikki Haley dropped out. And so the general election really kicked off this week, right? Mm-hmm. And the State of the Union very much seemed like that. It seemed like a campaign speech. I think that's the thing that I noticed. And of course, you know, with these things, we always kind of analyze it in terms of both its form and its content. I think that's especially the case with Biden, you know, looking at the form, not just in terms of the rhetoric, but the oratory, you know, because of the age issue. And so just kind of keeping to the form part of things, I thought he performed pretty well. I mean, there was some verbal stumbling kind of throughout, but I don't think that people, I think it makes it less likely that there's going to be a last minute kind of effort by the Democratic Party insiders to kick him off the ballot, because he seemed like he had things together. He seemed very energetic, obviously. But what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, it's a tribute to the value of setting expectations low. Because, like, on Twitter, what I was seeing was, you know, people, these are pro-Biden people, but they're, you know, they're people with reputations. It's not in their interest to kind of be caught out just flat out lying in public. And they were saying things like, not many people put it this strongly, but there was widespread satisfaction with it in Biden circles. And yeah, and a lot of cheering. And but some people were saying things like, this is the best speech Biden's ever given. And then I listened to it this morning, and yeah, it's actually pretty full of glitches. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not AVF, it's IVF, right?
Right.
Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there were really a fair number of them. And, you know, these people, if they're serious about this being the best speech, go back and listen to a speech of his 10 years ago. That would be an interesting exercise. I should go back and find like a speech while he's vice president, just 10 years ago. He's like 71 or something. I'm telling you, I think it's going to be night and day, even a prepared speech, mm-hmm, let alone impromptu speech. That said, I thought, you know, the part I got up to, I thought it was a pretty good speech. I thought leading with Ukraine, I'm still not sure exactly the logic. I mean, of course, you know, he was leading with the part of his worldview that drives me craziest, of course, like we are in a global, yeah, struggle between the forces of democracy and the forces of autocracy. And that's also what we face at home. Of course, that's one reason Ukraine made sense, is because he could weave it into what apparently is going to be his central vote for me message, which is Trump is bad.
Right.
So it was odd, but it didn't seem totally off key. Then he did. Then I thought, you know, we got into IVF or AVF, as he occasionally called it. I thought, you know, this really is a campaign speech. He's like, they've done the polling, and this is now they're targeting this particular, you know, segment of women and so on.
Right.
But then when he moved on to like the working man speech and the unions, I thought that was really pretty strong, because that's hitting Trump at home. It's like, yeah, this guy, let me show you, a male member of the white working class, you know, mm-hmm, he's head of the union. And I just thought that whole section, you know, was pretty strong.
And I agree with you that those things were driven by the campaign part of this. I mean, the Ukraine thing is, it is, as you say, part of this democracy versus autocracy thing. And it's a way to kind of unite the foreign policy and the domestic policy. You know, he was saying Trump is kind of a threat to democracy at home and abroad. Abroad, because, mm-hmm, he doesn't want to take on Putin. Of course, in the course of making this argument, hopefully his team has some idea that this has to do with leverage, and we're eventually going toward a negotiated settlement that's going to end the Ukraine war. I hope that that's the thinking, because he was, you know, reaffirming all these ideas that if we don't stop Putin now, he's going to march across Europe. We can't bow to Putin. We can't give an inch. Obviously, he has also the House Speaker behind him, who's been holding up a funding package. So that's kind of part, yeah, of what he's doing. And then, yeah, I agree about the abortion thing in IVF. He was connecting IVF to Roe v. Wade. And that is a political winner for the Democrats, whereas immigration is not. And another thing that I thought, I mean, it's hard to see these things objectively, but something that I think might play well for him is the contrast between him and the people who were heckling him, especially Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Now, I missed that part. I saw allusions to what happened with MTG and him. She was, during the speech, heckling him?
So the setup is beforehand, when he was walking through and everyone is, you know, trying to shake his hand and get a selfie with him, she has on a MAGA hat and a shirt that says, say her name. Apparently, this violates the dress code of the State of the Union, but that's neither here or there, I guess.
Whose name are we?
So it's Lakin Riley, this nursing student in Georgia who was killed by an illegal immigrant. Marjorie Taylor Greene hands Biden a button. I think it says, say her name. And then during the speech, when he's talking about immigration, Because, of course, right now the Democrats are trying to make it seem like Trump and Trumpist Republicans are, you know, inhibiting a bill that would address the issue of border security. I don't know how accurate that is, but that's the argument that they're making.
I think that part's true. I mean, I think Trump, I think it was pretty much ready to go and they'd worked it out, and certainly in the Senate, and Trump called him up and said, don't do this. Right.
Well, yeah, I think that part's true. It's just Biden undid a lot of executive orders of Trump's that I think Biden could just reinstate through his executive authority that he used to undo them. Okay. But maybe they think that that would be kind of awkward. So, yeah, during the speech, when he's talking about immigration, he's starting to get heckled. Marjorie Taylor Greene talking about say her name, and then he holds up the pen. And then, unfortunately, this was another one of the verbal flubs, because he says Lincoln Riley. He says, I'll say her name, Lincoln, not Lakin. And earlier in the speech, he had been talking about Abraham Lincoln. So I think it was kind of.
Sure. Who among us hasn't done?
Right. I think he probably did know her name, but he was kind of in that sort of mode, you know. He was just talking about Lincoln, and then the name sound kind of similar. All in all, though, I think this played to his benefit politically, because if you're not already a gung-ho MAGA person, this is like gross behavior during the State of the Union. I mean, it makes him seem like the adult. And then being old is maybe a good thing, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, look, as for like leading with the, you know, democracy, threats to democracy at home and abroad, they have a better idea than I do of all the polling, and they know who exactly they're targeting. However, there is reportedly like a disagreement within, you know, Democrat sage circles. About how strong they should emphasize that. And I think David Axelrod and people like that are saying, no, you shouldn't. You really need a positive policy message and less about Trump is evil. But I think I forget the name of the person who I guess is the advisor on this, that's maybe closest to Biden, some campaign guy who is who's all in on, who says is the closer the election gets, the more anti-Trump is going to work or something. I don't know.
As far as this, like, I think this is actually related to something where Biden's age is an asset, because, you know, a lot of the Republicans are trying to make it seem like he's evil, right? Like, that's their rhetoric. And, you know, Republicans do have this sense that Democrats, the liberal establishment, is using lawfare against Trump and trying to throw him off the ballot and resorting to anti-democratic means. A large percentage of them think that the last election was stolen, and that big tech intervened at the behest of the liberal establishment. But it's kind of with Biden, because he's so old, it's kind of hard to see him that way, as this like tyrannical.
It does make it harder. He definitely is looking plenty grandfatherly these days. And you saw that when he was walking in. I saw that part of it's very noticeable. But, you know, Trump has made his share of verbal flubs. I was thinking, like, maybe Trump will get the worst of this, because if he speaks more often in public and he loves to speak impromptu, he'll just have more flubs that you can put on social media. And maybe even if Biden is doing more per minute when he shows up, if he shows up less, he'll win the social media war. I don't know how this is going to work. And I mean, not that it almost matters what goes on social media now that, you know, so many people are confined to their own little cocoons on social media. But I have no idea. But and then what else? I didn't get to the part where he talks about Gaza. Did he kind of, I assume he announced this infrastructure we're building to circumvent the blockade put up by our ally, basically.
That was the most important thing he said about Israel, Gaza, I guess, just in terms of newsworthiness. You know, he mentioned they're building a pier in the Mediterranean. He said there won't be boots on the ground, although really, I mean, they won't be on the ground, but there are going to be soldiers, American soldiers in the Mediterranean Sea. There is a risk here of them being attacked.
Sure is.
In which case, the U.S. would probably or potentially become directly involved in the Gaza war, or there would be
I'd be kind pressure. Of surprised though if even Hamas wanted to attack them. I don't think Hezbollah does, and so I don't. I mean, this is assumes they don't set foot on land, but I kind of don't. You know, I mean, one of the few reassuring things to emerge from both the Ukraine war and the Gaza wars has been that the signaling, well, what do I want to call it? There hasn't been, the worst case escalation scenarios have not unfolded. And I think that's been partly because a number of important actors have acted like rational actors. And this defies stereotype in some cases, because half of the American foreign policy establishment is devoted to depicting Iran's leaders as a bunch of crazy religious fanatics. Iran has invariably been very carefully calculating in its moves, and it happened again. You know, they basically the thing they seem to have most control over, which is the militias in Iraq, they kind of have called off. The Houthis are another matter, but everybody said from the beginning that the Houthis, you know, are fairly autonomous. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering is, like, is it the case that maybe in the modern world with modern communications infrastructure, I mean, who knows how much backdoor actual communication is happening?
Right.
Is it? But certainly there's a lot more opportunity for, you know, public subtle signaling. Given the fact that you can get word out there instantaneously via social media or TV or whatever you want to use. And I'm wondering if that's, like, on balance, a stabilizing thing in situations like this, like you get fewer crossed signals or something. And look, I don't want to push this experiment much further at all, but the one piece of good news, you know, is that various important actors have respected red lines, I would say, well, in both Ukraine and the Middle East, although in a way more in the Middle East than Ukraine. But I digress. What's our newsletter about? Should we talk about our newsletter?
Yeah, so you wrote a lead that I haven't read all of, which is also about, you know, Trump versus Biden issues. Do you want to kind of summarize your argument?
Yeah, the piece isn't finished. Maybe you can tell me how to finish it. I mean, I think I know I want to finish it, but I should hurry because it's already kind of long, right? Mm-hmm. And as you notice, it reads less and less coherently as it goes. I assume that the final few paragraphs must have been pretty shabby, right?
Well, I didn't quite know where it was going in the final paragraph, so yeah, maybe.
It's just, so it starts out, I started thinking about it after Super Tuesday and thinking, okay, look, it's Biden versus Trump. A lot of people aren't happy with this choice. But at the same time, they care about it. I mean, even if Biden supporters wish they had somebody other than Biden, a lot of them are terrified of Trump. Mm-hmm. They really, you know, they're going to spend the next 8 months in anxiety. And a number of the Trump supporters, I guess, feel the same way. And the piece. It's a way of saying calm down, but not in the usual way. It's not reassuring in the usual way. The usual way, I mean, the easiest way would be to say, don't worry, Biden's going to win or something. Mm-hmm. But I'm making the argument. And I picked up on this Adam Tooze piece in Financial Times and use it as kind of the source text almost and quote it repeatedly.
It's a great piece. People should read it.
It is a good piece. He's a very good writer, occasionally a little elliptical, but he's very smart, an historian, and where was I? I was thinking, I think I looked him up on Wikipedia, and I think it says that his grandfather recruited Soviet spies at Oxford or something, maybe his great grandfather. Which I took to mean was working for the communists So anyway, a little tidbit about him. But I I've always been very impressed by him. And he's got this thing. He's basically saying, you know, look, everyone worries that Trump will tear the international order asunder. And he gets into how actually Biden has been pretty bad himself in that regard. And there's a couple little twists he does. One is he talks about the hypocrisy of America purporting to uphold the rules-based order and actually violating all the rules. But whereas that's normally done in the context of military intervention, he's talking largely about economics, like unilateral sanctions and all kinds of like gratuitous and impromptu economic weaponry. And so that's kind of interesting. But and then the other thing he does is he says that this kind of thing is especially acceptable in kind of Jake Sullivan's generation, which is kind of Gen X. Mm-hmm. Sullivan was born in like the mid 70s. And what Tu says is it's because the optimism about globalization has faded. The idea was globalization is this good thing. And that was very much the idea after the Cold War. It's worth defending and protecting. We need rules to protect it. And I think the U.S. on the economic front did used to comply with the rules much more. Mm. There's been a kind of unraveling of that, probably the last several presidential administrations. But anyway, Tu says, you know, these guys don't consider globalization their friend. They don't have the optimism about global economic engagement and interconnection. And that's why they're willing to play so fast and loose. And I think he thinks dangerously on the economic front.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe you are the one who kind of suggested connecting this to my standard sermon about non-zero sumness, and you know, we and that is where this is heading. I mean, the piece, so the point is to get back to the original thing, Biden versus Trump. It's like, look, if you have the worldview that I have and that the newsletter kind of has about international affairs, which is, look, we got a growing number of non-zero sum games we have to successfully play with other nations. We got to give up this democracy promotion shtick. It never works. It often backfires, and it just pisses people off. We can't afford to obsess over the values that prevail in every other country. We've got to work with countries to solve common problems, ranging from climate change to now AI, with a lot of stuff in between. The governance of outer space, weapons in space, just a ton of shit. And if you believe that, then both Trump and Biden are basically your enemy. I mean, you're not going to get any support for the next 4 years either way, because Biden's going to be doing this American exceptionalist democracy crusade that will make it very hard to actually cooperate systematically with other nations on critical issues. Mm-hmm. And Trump doesn't believe in international governance. So, you know, it's funny. It's like America first, this ruthless focus on national interest. That doesn't have to be a bad thing. If you recognize how often our interests overlap with other nations, that does mm-hmm. not, that would not actually rationally pursuing America's national interests would not lead to a Trump-esque foreign policy by and large. It would lead you to cultivate global governance. I mean, it would lead you to follow some of the advice he gives, even if he doesn't follow it himself. The kind of seemingly anti-militaristic rhetoric, which is not even consistent rhetorically, and in any event, he doesn't seem to abide by once he gets into office and decides to like assassinate anybody he feels like assassinating. So that's kind of the argument, is like, you know, for me, the next 4 years, you're not going to have a friend in the White House either way. I mean, you should vote for who you think will be the better candidate. But the idea that one of them is going to make the world a great place and one won't, by my ideological lights, no, they are both trouble on that front. Now, I know, you know, people, I think with some justice, worry about the domestic situation. If Trump is elected, Biden supporters do. I don't think that's crazy. I think it's overstated. And if you want to worry for that reason, worry. But as I prioritize policies, you know, the stuff that I think is most important for America and the world, my priorities will not be served by either administration. And so it's basically just, you know, spend the next 4 years strategizing, let them heighten the contradictions, as they say in the revolution business. and we'll see.
Yes. I mean, a couple of points on that. I think maybe one reason that liberals today are less optimistic about globalization than they were in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War is, in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War, their optimism was kind of wrapped up in this idea that all governments were heading towards liberal democracy. I mean, this is most eloquently expressed in, you know, Fukuyama's work, End of History. He really saw things as liberalism is the last ideology standing. It defeated communism's gone, fascism's gone. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of Hegelian dialectic where people are yearning for personal dignity, and inevitably this leads to liberal democracy. Right. And of course, and then, like, you know, the libertarian kind of spin on this is that economic liberalization in China is going to lead to political liberalization inexorably. And the fact that that didn't happen, I think, explains some of this. But that was never your hope. Maybe it was your hope, but that wasn't.
You're exactly right. I mean, no, it was my hope. Mm-hmm. And I still think that the jury is out on whether China can have enduring prosperity without engaging in some political liberalization in terms of civil liberties and whatever. Mm-hmm. Although there's actually more of certain kinds of freedom in China than is widely recognized. But in any event, but no, you're right. I mean, you know, I had him on the podcast some months ago. Frank, mm-hmm. and I know him fairly well, and I really regret it. I only realized afterwards, like, I kind of avoided this. We didn't engage on Ukraine, even though we both knew that we kind of disagree. And I didn't realize afterwards, it's such a straightforward extension of our books. It's like his worldview is threatened by an autocrat like Putin prevailing. Mm-hmm. And my world, the worldview expressed in the book Non-Zero, is threatened by us not getting together with all the world's nations, including Russia, and peacefully cooperating. So I don't like seeing us exacerbate tensions with Russia, which I think we did a lot of over the last 25 years. Especially in the name of democracy promotion, not that all of it was in that name, but so anyway, I mean, you're right. It's funny that our positions on Ukraine are really extensions of our world. But yeah, that has long been my view. That's the realist part of me, is that you just cannot afford, for the good of humankind and your own nation, you cannot afford to get too obsessed with remaking all nations in your image. Let them sort out their affairs. And, you know, obviously there are things, you know, there are crimes of a magnitude that you would try to organize an intervention, even if they're internal.
Mm-hmm.
But we spend way too much time lecturing other countries, I think. So, yeah, that's the lead. And then
maybe we should transition to the next part of this episode, like overtime. Is now a good time to do
it? Oh, yeah. You tell me. Yeah, it is good. I mean, well, let's talk about what we're going to talk about. So we're going to talk about some AI stuff, including some I wished I'd talked about with Tim Lee more. I just did an AI podcast with him.
Russia, Ukraine, couple stories about the draft peace treaty from April 2022 that Wall Street Journal got its hands on.
Yeah.
NATO troops in Ukraine, what are they doing there? some more stuff on Israel, the secret arms deals that Biden has apparently been delivering to Israel.
Shady.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, is there more? Oh, JFK assassination. No, but I'm going to connect it to the current international situation in a way that's going to blow your mind. And I can't wait. I pity the person who doesn't choose to follow us beyond the paywall.
And to do that, click the link in the show notes, go to the Non-Zero newsletter on Substack and become a paid subscriber. Then you get all the bonus audio content and the bonus written content, which is a lot.
Mm. Plus, help pay Andrew's salary. Andrew,
right.
You're not awash in cash, but you need the money, right?
I do desperately.
You need it.
Yeah.
And it'll just go
right to my bank account. So,
right.
Please.
Mm-hmm. And go straight to the crypto.
All right. So, let's go to overtime.
All right.
This was a free preview of Earthling Unplugged. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive audio content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.